Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If there was to have been a celebration, then it would have been this past week to mark the 10th birthday party for NAFTA. But in all three North American nations, there wasn't much of a rush to polish up the party shoes. 10 years into North American free trade, the deal remains as controversial and as difficult to assess as it was when the original debate was held. This hour on The Connection, we'll look at what the deal has meant with specific reference to the USA and Mexico. It's a useful time to take that measure as President Bush prepares to unveil his new guest worker program for Mexicans in America. But this is a story about successes and failures, about jobs lost and gained. We'd like you to join us with your assessment. What has NAFTA meant to you? Has it brought the prosperity that some promised or the losses that others forewarned? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start today with the Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz. He wrote yesterday that there is no real reason to celebrate. He's joining us on the line from New York. Mr. Stiglitz, nice to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Why no cause for celebration in your assessment of NAFTA?
Well, there's a slight cause of celebration. The risk that people talked about, the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about, no serious economist took it seriously, and there has not been that problem. After the signing of NAFTA, the unemployment rate in the United States continued to fall. We went down to 3.8%. The reason I think there's no celebration is that it wasn't the panacea, the magic bullet that so many people wanted, so many people thought was being promised. Mexico's economy has not performed in a stellar way. In fact, its growth over the last decade has been much weaker than it was in the decades, say, following 1948, 1950. The gap between the United States and Mexico has continued to grow. Real wages in Mexico have actually fallen in the last decade. So certainly people in Mexico feel, I think, justifiably disappointed. Mm-hmm. And it has brought some problems for Mexico. American agriculture is extremely efficient. But on top of that, the U.S. government subsidizes American corn enormously. And poor Mexican corn farmers are finding it very, very difficult to compete with subsidized American corn. I think, finally, when I was in the Council of Economic Advisors when we were discussing this, and we thought it was not going to have the huge benefits that were often being touted. After all, tariffs between the United States and Mexico were already fairly low. Mm-hmm. We thought it was important as a, you might call it, a gesture of good neighborliness to build closer geopolitical ties. And I think much of the goodwill that we might have expected has been squandered, partly after the fact, after the signing of NAFTA. We tried to use all kinds of non-tariff barriers. We tried to keep out their avocados, their tomatoes, their trucks. We said that their exports of a particular kind of brooms called broom corn brooms was a threat to the U.S. economy, and we put safeguard tariffs on it and tried to keep them out in the United States. So that by our action, we really undermined of what was a free trade agreement.
Let me ask you, back when NAFTA was first signed, you spoke about the huge benefits that were promised. Supporters at that time were claiming that it was going to create such equality between the U.S. and Mexico that the rush then of Mexican illegal migrants would end. We know that didn't happen. So when we look at the president getting set to announce his foreign guest worker program today, is that for you an indication that NAFTA has failed?
Well, you know, the migration is related to the gap in wages gap in incomes between the United States and Mexico. It's one of the largest gaps across any border in the world. And I think there was a hope that NAFTA would narrow that gap by bringing up Mexico. What has happened, in fact, is the gap between the United States and Mexico has actually increased by about 10% over the decade. Mm-hmm. That means that the migration pressure, if anything, has increased, not decreased. And so I think it is perfectly understandable that there should be this concern. I think that there is a broader concern among many people that, you know, Mexican migrants are people too, and they ought to be given basic civil rights, human rights, and that we have not done the way we've treated them is really often been despicable.
So if we were to try and zero in your mind on what went wrong over the past 10 years, you're saying that there was really a lack of goodwill on the part of this country when it came to honoring, if not the letter, then the spirit of the agreement.
I think that's right. But I think it's also the fact that too much emphasis was placed on trade alone. People thought that some people thought that trade by itself was going to be, as I said, a magic bullet. If Mexico is going to succeed, it's going to need to improve the quality of its education, its infrastructure, a number of aspects of Mexico that are really Mexico's responsibilities. Mexico's tax base, tax revenues are a very low level. And because of that, it's not going to be able to compete with more dynamic economies like the dynamic economies in Asia.
Okay, but would you have given the same advice that you gave President Clinton? Would you say today, yes, do NAFTA, it's a good thing?
Yes, I would. But I would say, let's do it. Let's really have a good neighborly policy. Let's really try to make this a successful experiment. And let's try to help them with their infrastructure. Let's try to work with them let's have an education program, work with them in opening up our markets in a more fully integrated way.
Mr. Stiglitz, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is economics professor at Columbia University, former chief economist of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000, and as he mentioned, was head of and a member of the Council of American Economic Advisers in the 1990s when NAFTA was put into place. Let's take a look at one particular industry here, because when you ask economists and analysts what one of the successes of NAFTA is, everybody will point to the automobile industry. And joining us on the line now is Antonio Madero. He is chairman and chief executive officer of the San Luis Corporation. It is a Mexican company that is the largest supplier of suspension components to the United States. Mr. Madero, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Glad to be with you, Dick.
I want you to take us back, if you will, to, well, before NAFTA, because you made a decision to buy the company you now own back in the 1980s. Why did you decide at that point that an auto parts company based in Mexico was a good investment?
We knew that Mexico had to grow its markets outside the Mexican economy and become a more global country economically if it were to make progress, and that the automotive manufacturing industry was going to be one of those industries which could progress under that scheme. That's why we decided to buy a company which make them automotive components, and that's when we bought Racini, our subsidiary, which makes suspensions components and brake components for the U.S. automotive industry. That was back in 1988. NAFTA was then being started to be negotiated. I participated very directly in the negotiations of NAFTA. It was a very difficult process. People didn't believe in Mexico, didn't believe in the United States on the NAFTA process. But finally, the parties were brought together. And I think that the results have been, in the automotive industry, which I know, spectacularly successful.
Now,
by joining our hands, the American industry and the Mexican automotive industry have made the North American industry more competitive altogether. The consumer has benefited in the United States by having access to lower price products than otherwise would have been the case.
Mr. Madero, my notes show that you've done spectacularly well here. You now have 7 plants in Mexico, 4 in Brazil, 1 in the States, You took a $70 million company, turned it into a $500 million company. I do want you to talk a little bit about the workers, if you would, because Joe Stiglitz was just saying that if we look across the board, Mexican workers haven't done as well as people thought they would. What do you say to that?
When you look at the gross statistics, Professor Stiglitz might be right, but when you look at the automotive industry statistics and the manufacturing sector statistics, I think that you have to become more precise. In the case of our company, for example, the average wages went up from $1 fully costed back in 1988, $1 per hour, to almost $4 per hour fully costed today. That's a fourfold increase in wages in the period of 10 years.
These are Mexican workers we're talking about,
Mexican
too, right?
Mexican workers, yeah. Yes. I'm talking about Mexican workers, not Brazilian or American workers. I'm talking about Mexican workers. We have to develop, we have to become a high-quality company, consistently high-quality company, excellent service company, very client-oriented. So we have to develop a very strong labor force with substantially better qualifications than they had before. We took people from the farm, in many cases, and had to train them in basics, have to develop them into qualified workers that raise their standard of living, that raise their quality of life. In the case of one of our plants in northern Mexico, we had to build 1,000 homes because there was no home availability. We had to improve their schools so the children of our workers will be better educated, and that will be an attraction to our workers.
Mr. Madero, there's something I wanted to ask you about, and that is what has changed in the way of doing business? You started in this business back in the late 1980s. We're now in the year 2004. Over that period of time, while NAFTA has taken effect, has it become really that much easier for Mexican companies to do business with American companies?
We have become a part of the American economy in the manufacturing sector. It has been much, much easier from the standpoint that there's a great deal of confidence and trust between the parties because there's this trade agreement that eliminates barriers and assures access to the markets. There is no any longer any possibility of a unilateral action eliminating one of these agreements because these are international treaties. So there's a great deal of trust and confidence among the parties, our customers and we as suppliers. Number two, we changed from a Mexican-oriented industry to a North American-oriented industry and to a global-oriented industry.
Mr. Madero, I'm a little short on time here. I have one more quick question for you, and that is,
sure. How
do you take the benefits that you see in the auto industry and spread that out to the entire Mexican economy?
By having the Mexican private sector become more global-oriented, by having the Mexican government execute more of the reforms that are still pending, like Professor Stiglitz very well said, such as education, infrastructure, tax, to bring the Mexican economy more in line to the competitive economy that it requires to be. I would say that's a very, very specific answer to your question.
Mr. Madero, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much, Dick.
Antonio Madero is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the San Luis Corporation. Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we're going to be talking with John Coatsworth, Director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard University, go a little bit further into an understanding of what the promise of NAFTA was and what the reality was. We'll also be checking in with the President of the United Steelworkers Union Local 915 in Huntsville, Alabama. Billy Brewer has a different perspective on exactly what's happening with the automotive industry from his seat in this country. We would also like to have you join our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What about the promise of NAFTA? How has it played out as you've seen it? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, and that's your invitation to join our conversation this hour about assessing NAFTA 10 years after the free trade agreement for all of North America was signed. Joining me in our studio here, John Coatsworth. He is an economic historian and director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard University, and it's a return visit for you, John. It's nice to have you back in the studio.
Good morning, Dick.
Tell me, you've been listening to what both Joseph Stiglitz and Antonio Madero had to say, and I'm I'm drawn to ask you the same question that I'm still puzzled about, the promise of NAFTA. I mean, the people who said it was going to be great said it was really going to be the panacea for the nation. Those who said it was, you know, going to be this giant sucking sound, pulling all the jobs out, were determined that was going to be the case. And neither has been, has come to be the truth.
Exactly right. NAFTA was oversold to begin with, and it's being over-criticized now. If you look at any number, trade, job creation, job loss, the numbers are too small, actually, to dedicate a whole program to. The U.S. economy has probably lost a few hundred thousand jobs, and it's probably gained a few hundred thousand more in an economy that creates, in an average year, 2, 3, 4 million jobs a year. In an economy with a labor force of 140 million, a few hundred thousand here or there doesn't really amount to you know, anything anybody in the government would talk about above the level of an intern. Or maybe a deputy assistant secretary of something. So the impact was small, has been small. It was going to be small from the beginning. If you look just at the economic numbers, some factory jobs have been lost to Mexico, but those jobs have made it possible for other jobs to be created in the United States, some of them better paying and on average better paying. But the numbers are small. Very few people have lost their jobs, and 100,000 people have applied for benefits under the NAFTA compensation program. Mm-hmm. So if you can prove your factory closed because the jobs moved to Mexico, you can get training funds, you can get some benefits. Only 100,000 have actually applied.
It's pretty easy, though, for a company to make the case that the closure of a factory isn't a direct NAFTA thing, but you know, a consolidation or a global shift.
Sure.
I mean, it's all the rules that were put in place by NAFTA are actually quite precise and in many cases difficult for people to get their hooks into, aren't they?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the reason for that is that NAFTA didn't change very much. We had virtual free trade between Mexico and the United States before NAFTA came in.
And the Canada Free Trade Agreement had been in place for 5 years.
It already existed.
So what was NAFTA?
Most of the jobs that got lost would have been lost anyway. Most of those gained would have been gained anyway. NAFTA was, to use Antonio Madero's phrase, its main effect was on trust and confidence. That is, on the U.S. side, we gained the assurance that Mexico would never adopt a series of crazy economic policies, hyperinflation, and the instability that goes with it, because NAFTA constrains what their government can do in economic policymaking. And on the Mexican side, they got the assurance that the United States wasn't going to arbitrarily close its border. Or at least that's the assurance they thought they got. And they got something else, too. With the assurance that Mexico is not going to change its economic policy arbitrarily, confiscate, nationalize, do some crazy things, American investors thought Mexico was a much better bet now. And they invested in companies like San Luis and in other Mexican companies that promised to be profitable. They would have been profitable anyway, but now investors knew that things were not going to change all of a sudden overnight and make their investments and kill their investments. So there were benefits, but they were not – the trade benefits had always been there.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear about your own personal assessment of NAFTA. We're going to take our first call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
All right. My comment is this. I used to live in Louisiana, and I frequented a little town, did business in a little town called St. Martinville down there, where the Evangeline Oak is, the Gabriel Oak, Bayou Teche, all of those wonderful food. Also, a big, huge plant operated by Fruit of the Loom and employed 3,200 people. It had been there for years, and it was expanding. That's one reason I was doing business there. And soon after NAFTA, all of those jobs went to Mexico. 3,200 people in a little town like that out of work. And also, I live up here in North Carolina right now, and we have felt that greatly here. So many jobs lost.
Now what you're looking at in North Carolina is jobs that are going to China. Is that right, Paul?
That's exactly right. I was just about to say that. First to Mexico, now to China. And
let me just check with John.
This is terrible. I don't understand why our government undermines working people in this country just for a buck.
2 points. The first is every year about 8 million jobs in the United States turn over, created or lost. And that's been going on for decades and decades, long before free trade. Some industries can't make it. Others take their place. in the case of industries that are losing their jobs to cheap labor abroad, those industries, when that happens, there's also a positive effect. New jobs are created in the United States that would not have existed otherwise. Jobs to export to those countries where the factories have been located. Jobs that in industries that are now more viable than they would have been because they're more competitive.
Is that something that is solid and measurable? Because you and I both know, John, that people like Paul, who have these direct personal experience of seeing large factories close, mm-hmm. you know, say that town was wiped out, all those jobs were gone. Show me where the benefit was. I mean, the fact sure. is you and I can go to the grocery store and buy a basket of strawberries or an avocado in March because it comes from Mexico.
Right.
You know, we don't pick that avocado up and go, whoopee, NAFTA, you know.
Well, the way you can think about it is this. The Fruit of the Loom factory closed. It moved first to Mexico. No doubt it's moved on to China. And when you go to Walmart and buy Fruit of the Loom underwear, you're now paying much less than you would otherwise. And with the money that you're not spending on underwear, you're now buying other things. And those jobs have to be created somewhere. Some of them are going to be created in the U.S. Some of them are going to be created in other foreign countries. But it's a nut. You can't think of jobs migrating out of the country as a net loss. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they involve a net gain. And in fact, with NAFTA and most of the other trade agreements, we've lost jobs. It's true. And when it happens to a community that depends on it, it's tragic. But we've also gained jobs, and most of the jobs we've gained are better paying than the ones we've lost.
All right, Paul, thanks very much for your call. I want to bring Billy Brewer into our conversation now. Billy's on the line from Huntsville, Alabama. He's president of the Steelworkers Union, Local 915 there. And Billy, if I'm not mistaken, 28 years at the Dunlop plant in Huntsville, Alabama. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
I wonder if you can take us back to when NAFTA was first being talked about in the early 1990s. Do you remember that time? Do you remember what people were saying then?
Well, I can remember what I was thinking. You know, you had when it all came together, you know, you had five presidents, present and past, standing there saying this was the thing to do. And I was having a hard time figuring that out because I figured that jobs would be lost. And here, 10 years later, this plant is being closed by that.
I want to talk to you about that in just a minute, but I want to kind of step through those 10 years from 1993 up through the late 90s and the beginning of this particular century. Was the plant growing? Was the plant shrinking? What was happening?
The plant employed about 1,650 people in the early 90s, around 91, 2, 3, long in there.
Yeah.
And as the years went by, you know, it just steadily decreased. And at the time of the plant closure, we were running about 1,000 people. So, it was just through attrition, you know. It wasn't massive layoffs. We had one, but it was letting it slowly go down, you know.
Now, a lot of these 1,650 people, were they union workers?
Oh, they were all union workers.
So these are people making $20 and more an hour.
Right.
It's a huge part of Huntsville's economy, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
So tell me, when did you get the news that the plant itself was being closed?
This came in October.
And what did Goodyear say at that time, Billy? Because they're telling us this doesn't have anything to do with NAFTA.
Oh, well, it must, just to clarify that, because we qualified for benefits under NAFTA and TRA. So it was the tires, you know, the tires in the last 10 years coming out of Mexico have doubled. And, you know, now the enemy is China. That's where it's going now. Those tires are leaving Mexico and going to China and Korea. That's what's coming into our country now, and it's devastating the tire industry.
What's your feeling about this, Billy? I mean, you listened to John just a couple of moments ago mm-hmm. say that, you know, when there's a job lost in the United States, there are, you know, savings for consumers and jobs created. Do you see evidence of that in Huntsville?
Well, there's not a lot here in Huntsville. We do have some, you know, we have NASA and Boeing, but, you know, these are smokestack industry jobs. You know, this is heavy industry. You know, this is manual labor that happens in the tire industry. You know, it's not easy work. It's not a lot of mental work. It's very, very physical, you mm-hmm. know. And that's not what these high tech jobs. That's not what they're looking for. You know, I've been a tire builder for 28 years. You know, I don't think NASA is going to hire me to do something for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, John Coatsworth. Billy puts his finger on something that's really key here. That a lot of the people who are being and have been displaced by global trade, whether it's NAFTA or China or whatever, are not the people who are going to wind up with the high tech jobs or the services.
Exactly right. And the reason why their criticism is misplaced is because if we lived in a society that had a decent social welfare net, so that when somebody lost their job for whatever reason, they could have the assurance of free health care. They knew their kids were going to get a good education through college. They knew that they were going to get unemployment benefits for an extended period of time, that someone would help them to move where there were better jobs waiting for them, where there was retraining that was targeted to their skills and knowledge and to the local industries that they might work in. If we had programs in place that did a better job than the programs we have now, the people who are complaining about NAFTA would have less to complain about, and we'd be able to make a more productive economy with less pain and less suffering when inevitably less productive factories move someplace else looking for cheaper labor. I think much of what the criticism, we're criticizing NAFTA, but we should be criticizing Washington on other grounds, that they're not doing a decent job, as other developed countries have done, to create the social welfare net that would make it possible for people to lose their jobs and not worry about their health, their education, and all of the other things that people worry about when factories close.
Billy, tell me what that looks like for you when you talk about figuring out where your health care expenses are going to come from, education taxes, all that sort of thing, looking 6 months, 6 years ahead. What do you see?
Well, I see it not a very good future, especially for the majority of these workers. That benefit and what the gentleman said before, you know, we've got to come up with some kind of national health care. That's the biggest problem right now for any worker that's displaced, you know, is what happens to my family. And some of these things got to happen. But he's absolutely right on it. I have no idea what the government what they're thinking and what they want to do to us.
Can you stay with us, Billy? I'd like to go back to our callers, but I want you to stay on the program if you've got a few minutes. Is that all right?
Sure, I will.
Okay, Marcio from Boston is joining us now on the line. Marcio, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks a lot. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just wanted to point out some reasons why Mexicans have been unhappy with NAFTA.
Okay.
So the first one would be that the economy has not grown, and the evidence of that is in the real wages. The real wages have not gone up in the past few years. The second reason would be, you know, the farm workers have been very affected by NAFTA's rules, in which the subsidies of U.S. Agriculture would have to be lifted under the NAFTA rules and have not been lifted, since it was implemented, and has affected farm workers in a sense that U.S. corn has been dumped in Mexico.
Marcio, are you from Mexico yourself?
No, I'm actually from Brazil.
So
I've been following quite closely.
I mean, I'm just your perspective as a Brazilian, because the whole notion of expanding NAFTA to Central American and South American free trade. Are people pretty suspicious about that?
Very much so. They think that FTAA will be expanding NAFTA to the rest of Latin America, and the same thing that's happening to Mexico now would happen to other Latin American countries, including Brazil.
Marcio, thanks for your call. I want to turn to John Coatsworth here, because agriculture is a huge part of this story, and not one that's particularly flattering from the American perspective.
That's correct. I think Mexican negotiators were not aware. They couldn't have been aware at the time they negotiated NAFTA of the extent to which the United States government would increase its subsidies to corn farmers in the U.S. And therefore make it much easier for Mexican corn, for U.S. corn to sell in Mexico at lower prices. It's still the case, even with those subsidies, however, that the state of Illinois produces more corn than all of Mexico and does it at a quarter of the cost of Mexican production.
I mean, just the efficiencies alone. Illinois could outproduce Mexico on the basis of the technology that farmers in Illinois
use.
Better, they don't need the subsidies,
no, they
do
don't.
They?
They have better soil. They have better climate. They have better technology. Mexico should not be producing corn. There's no reason why a country that has that climate and that terrible terrain and those difficulties should be producing grain at all, at least in most parts of the country. So consumers in the cities in Mexico are much better off because they're getting cheaper corn, and they're also getting cheaper beef and pork because the feed grains are mostly what we're exporting. But if you look at it from the other point of view, there are between 1 and 3 million Mexican farm families that now cannot produce corn and make a profit for themselves at prices that corn is selling for in Mexican markets, and they're going to have to find something else to do.
There was an argument that, and I know this argument was important in all conversations about free trade in Europe between Canada and the United States, about what a country ought to be able to produce itself. The idea that a country should be producing some of its own food so it is not completely dependent on another country. I'm thinking of Huntsville, Alabama. The idea that a country ought to be producing some of its own hard goods so it's not completely dependent on countries like China and Mexico. That whole notion has pretty well gone out the window now with global trade, hasn't it?
Oh, it's way out the window. Most of the trade, more than half of all international trade nowadays, is trade that's taking place within companies. It's a company making a part in Indonesia and another part in Thailand and another part in Mexico and assembling it in Detroit. It's a company that's making sneakers in five different locations, and they all come together and they're assembled in a maquiladora on the Mexican border. Mm. More than half of all world trade is taking place in these production chains within companies. So it's Reebok exporting to Reebok, or it's GM exporting from one country to GM in another country. And if countries that don't form part of those production chains lose. The only Latin American country that's forming part of those production chains in significant industries with high tech is Mexico. And it's partly because of NAFTA and the investments that went into NAFTA afterwards. It's true Mexican wages have not risen over the last 10 years, but they would have fallen a lot further had they not had the advantage of these new investments and at the higher wages in factories like those that Antonio Madero was creating.
And probably worth noting that Mexico would not have recovered as effectively as it did from its currency crisis in 1994 if it hadn't made this pact with the United States.
Oh, absolutely. And you can see that in the auto sector. Mexicans were thrown out of work. The economy went into a crisis. Mexicans stopped buying automobiles, and the automobile industry hummed right along because when the peso collapsed, automobiles got cheaper, and they could be exported to the United States, and instead of being sold to Mexicans, they were sold to people in the U.S.
And although the automobile industry hummed right along, you have plants all over the United States, not unlike the Dunlop plant in Huntsville, Alabama, where Billy Brewer is contemplating the thousand of workers who are going to be out of work there. So everything looks either half full or half empty. Nothing is particularly easy in making sense of NAFTA. Takes us back to the original debate and connection. Listeners, we'd like to have your thoughts on how it has affected you. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join our conversation on this, the 10th year anniversary of the North American Free Trade Agreement. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. With me in the studio here in Boston, John Coatsworth. He's an economic historian of Mexico, a Harvard professor and director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Billy Brewer is also with us. He is president of the United Steelworkers Union Local 915. He has been working for the past 20 years at the Dunlop plant in Huntsville, Alabama, making tires for Goodyear. It's a plant that closed just last month. And we'd like to hear from you on the program. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Portsmouth, Virginia. Robert's joining us now. Hi, Robert.
Yes. I really disagree with your speaker there. I've worked in steel and in manufacturing, and those jobs are gone. And I care about my community, my family. I don't care about Mexico, and I don't care about China. And I think if we look at just the trade deficit, that is an indication of what is really going on. And I really disagree with this guy.
So be more specific, Robert. John Coatsworth here is saying, you know, this is what's happening in the world of trade. Are you saying that he's wrong?
Where he's coming from is more from philosophy and aesthetics rather than reality. And I've been across this country, and I have family members in other states who work in industries that are that went to Mexico. My
right.
brother helped move two factories there, and I'm saying this guy is very, very wrong. I don't know where he lives, and I think he should probably leave the college where he's teaching and get a real job.
I'm going to let John speak directly to you. Stay with us, Robert.
Getting a real job, I think I'm probably not qualified for, so I'll just have to stay where I am. But I couldn't agree more with you that trade and economic growth of any kind, whether it's trade or not, creates pain because as the economy changes, some jobs just disappear. Sometimes they disappear to foreign countries, but sometimes they just disappear altogether. And the real issue for us, actually there are two real issues. One is, how much should the consumers of the United States, through the government or directly, subsidize people in industries that no longer can produce as efficiently as other industries or producing things that people don't want to buy anymore?
Let me say this. The word consumer to me is on par with slave, helot, words like that. I'm willing to pay higher prices if it makes this country stronger and supports families in this country. If you want to be a globalist, I don't even understand that. That is very, very wrong. Our country.
I think it's an interesting place to be here because, you know, you can go to Walmart and you can buy a pair of underwear. You can go to the local tire manufacturer and you can buy a tire. And nobody's saying, in a really straightforward way, that tire, that's from China. That's $69. That tire comes from Huntsville, Alabama. It's $89. You choose.
Right.
It's an interesting thing that the retailers aren't presenting to customers.
They're not, but the customers are making those decisions already. That is, the plants that are closing are plants that can't produce the $69 tires, and people are not buying their $89 tires. That's why they're moving to other places. So, and this doesn't, it doesn't matter whether they're moving outside the country or they're moving to some other place in the country or they're trying to break a union or they're trying to get their costs down by borrowing cheaper or whatever. Businesses will try and produce more efficiently, that is, at lower cost. And as that happens, people are going to get hurt. And the real issue is not what we're doing about trade policy. The real issue is, do we have a government that responds when people get hurt as a result of economic change? And the answer is, we have, among the industrial powers of the world, the worst government there is, because we don't provide for people who are in the condition, who are in circumstances of pain as a result of the way the economy is changing.
Can I say this? People don't want to be on welfare and they don't want handouts. People want jobs where they can earn a decent living for their families and have families. The median income in this country now is about $24,000. The poverty level, that's for a family of four, the poverty level is $18,000. You know, if anything slips in the economy that we live in now, it's going to make the Great Depression look like a blip.
Robert, I want to thank you for your call.
You're
I
welcome.
Want to go to Billy Brewer in Huntsville. Billy, you're listening to this. I want to go back to hear your response to what I was asking John here, whether or not people would pay more if they actually believed that by doing that, they'd be preserving jobs either in their own town or halfway across the country.
Well, in the way our country's going now and even the people and their attitudes, I'm not sure they would. I think that's why they're letting these things happen. They're letting the government do the things that they do as far as moving these things offshore. It's, what can you do for me generation? You know, it's me. So I don't know that they would. Sure, everybody's real concerned in the town it happens in, but the rest of America could care less, I think, sometimes, you know.
So when you talk
when people really want to do something is when they get pinched. You know, when they feel the pinch, then it's time to do something.
And so what are people, your colleagues from the plant, saying now? What are their options?
Well, we did qualify for some training, and some of the guys and ladies are going to school maybe to try to be a nurse if they're young enough and make a career out of it, and a lot of people just try and do something with it, maybe drive a truck. So I've got the specter going all over, you know.
All right, stay with me. I'm going to go to Shiraw, South Carolina now. James is joining us on the line. And James, you're the head of a community college there, am I right?
That's correct.
Tell me what you're seeing in terms of the effect of NAFTA, whether or not you're getting people like the ones that Billy works with who are coming in for retraining.
We are, and I guess it's just a matter of perspective, you know, whether the glass is half full or half empty. In the area that we serve, which is a three-county area in South Carolina, it's very rural. Two counties, unemployment rates have fluctuated between 17% and 20%. And this is not only attributable to NAFTA, but it's attributable to the trade issues that are going on with China and India. One of the points that I wanted to make was that for every manufacturing job that's lost, we can look to the service industry, and we lose about 1.25 service jobs. So as you are moving people through training, there are only so many service-related positions out there that these people can move to. And so it really devastates small rural economies. I've seen the effects over and over again.
James, let me interrupt you for a minute here. I just wanted to help you clarify something for me. If one of the steelworkers were to come to the community college and say, you know, I was making $24-25 an hour at the Dunlop plant, is there anything you can train me for that will give me a comparable income? What do you say to that person?
There are some things, but you know, those industries may not be hiring. We could put them into a machine tool program or a computer numeric control program, something that's industrial related. But those industries that are local may or may not be hiring, and that's directly attributed to the economy.
And John, I guess as I'm listening to James, and James, thanks for your call. It's an interesting perspective you bring to us. It is the 10th anniversary of NAFTA, but does that mean it's an appropriate time to make some decisions about how good or how bad it has been? Are we too early or too late to say this is what the effect of NAFTA has been for Americans?
I don't think we're too early or too late. The effect of NAFTA has been very small, at least if it's measured in terms of jobs lost or jobs gained, how much faster our economy is growing. And the same is true for Mexico, although the impact there has been a bit larger and more positive. But NAFTA has become a symbol. It's become a symbol of something that Americans are deeply offended by, which is the notion that that we have an economy which doesn't take care of people properly, that allows them to suffer. It's a kind of savage capitalism in contrast to systems elsewhere in the world, and Americans don't like it. They don't like that their communities can be devastated without anybody stepping in to help restore jobs.
Okay, but Ronald Reagan, who began this in the late 80s, and Bill Clinton, who picked it up after him, spoke about the North American Free Trade Agreement as bringing benefits to this country. When you go back to their original ideas and what they were trying to tell Americans at the time, do we look at NAFTA as kind of like a stepping off into global trade? Is it accurate for people who see jobs disappearing to China from their hometown today to rail at NAFTA as part of the bad guy here?
Well, if you look at freer trade policies in general, the World Trade Agreement, for example, which is separate from NAFTA and had a much bigger impact at NAFTA itself and the other kinds of free trade agreements that have been signed or are in prospect, the effect has been to make the economy of the United States much more global. It's also made it much more dynamic and much more productive. The result has not been a trickle-down of benefits to many people, and in some cases, people have suffered. But that's a problem of not of trade policy, which has made us more productive. That's a problem of social policy, which we don't focus on enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. CP's on the line. Hi, CP. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I'm a retired engineer, and one of the things that brings high-tech jobs like engineering is manufacturing. And we're seeing engineering jobs move overseas, too. And one of the things that I wanted to ask, what are these high-tech jobs that these people are going to be able to move into when they lose their job?
It's a good question, John, because, I mean, I saw something in the newspaper today that said all these stock traders in New York making $150,000 a year are going to be knocked out of their jobs because there are smart, well-educated, young, English-speaking Indian economists in Bombay and Bangalore who'll do the same work for $20,000 and live very well on that.
That's a real threat. IBM worldwide built 6 plants last year. Some of them would have been built in the U.S. or in Mexico. Where they invested their overseas plants was in China. And they didn't go there for cheap labor. They went there because China is now educating more engineers than we are.
So is CP right that we need to in order to preserve the engineering high-tech skills, also hold on to some of the manufacturing like the Dunlop plant in Huntsville?
Well, you can protect all you want, but if you protect too much, you make the American economy inefficient, and then we don't really respond to the challenges ahead of us. What we need to do is to find ways of making those stockbrokers, who are now not needed because they're cheaper people doing the work elsewhere in the world, give them something else to do that will justify the salaries that they've been making. If somebody will do it cheaper, why should we pay somebody in New York $150,000 if there's someone in India or China that will do it for $50,000? The product that they will then be producing is a service that's too costly, and eventually they're going to lose anyway. We have to find a way of continuing to make the economy of the United States dynamic, discovering new products and new services for which we can charge and for which people are willing to pay. And we've been enormously successful in doing that over the years.
Billy Brewer, what do you tell either your kids or graduating seniors at a high school in Huntsville about what they should be looking forward to?
Well, the medical is somewhere good to go, nurse or a therapist or something like that. That's what we talk about among ourselves, what they should be trying to look for, or it used to be maintenance jobs, but seem like that's dying too, now I really don't know what to look for.
Do you agree with the sense of what John's saying here, that there's really no winding the clock back, that the types of jobs that you and your friends had aren't going to be in this country?
I don't believe we'll ever get them back. It's going to be a real uphill battle for labor. And I think we've got a ways to go before the people are really ready to take it on and get the industries back, But it'd be very difficult, very difficult.
Sometime in the next year, people in Alabama, people all over this country are going to be making some political decisions based on what they see. Do you think politicians are going to be criticized or punished or pushed to make some of the changes that John's been talking about?
I think they have to be. They have to be. It's too much going on. And a lot of people are getting pinched, as I said earlier. There's a lot of people getting pinched. You read it every day. And hopefully people will wake up. Something's got to happen.
Billy, I want to thank you for being on the program with us.
No, thank you.
Billy Brewer is president of the United Steelworkers Union, Local 915. John Coatsworth, last quick question for you. Same thing that I asked Billy. We were in an election year, and we're hearing the Democrats mutter about this, but I don't know whether or not it's going to grow legs. It's going to be a real issue in this campaign.
I don't know either. If the economy continues to boom, it probably won't be. But the Democrats have a point, and that is if there are going to be trade agreements, they need to have an institutional and regulatory complement that addresses environment, labor standards, safety, and the like. And that's something that that trade agreements have been very poor about incorporating. NAFTA's done a reasonable job, actually better than I had expected. But those are issues that Democrats are going to continue to raise. And if the economy doesn't continue to boom, people are going to be listening more and more.
Thanks for coming in, John. John Coatsworth, director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard University. Earlier in the program, we talked with Antonio Madero, chairman and chief executive officer of the San Luis Corporation, making auto parts in Mexico and around the world. Joseph Stiglitz was also with us. He is a professor at Columbia University, a professor of economics. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.